there, welcome back. I hope you're having a good day so far. My name is Henrik, and this is, of course, Red Ice Radio. Today we're talking with Andreas Bachmeier, a German homeopath now living in Switzerland. He is behind the website vaccineinjury.info and has been involved in conducting a thorough and comprehensive scientific survey on the state of health of unvaccinated children with more than 17,500 participants from all over the world. Andreas also authored the book Vaccine Free, 111 Stories of Unvaccinated Children, which was a direct follow-up to some of the cases in the survey. In this program, we are going to discuss the results of the survey and how it was conducted, including the most dangerous ingredients, aluminum and mercury, and the number of health issues that has been attributed to vaccines. For example, behavioral problems, neurological disease, autoimmune diseases, autism, and narcolepsy. Welcome, Andreas. Thank you for coming on with us. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for the invitation. Thanks, Henrik.
You bet, you bet. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your background here, first of all, before we get to the meat of our conversation, which is going to be very interesting. You guys have done an excellent survey, of course, and you have a lot of information about this. But tell us your background a little bit and how you ended up in Switzerland, Andreas.
So actually, I'm a homeopath, and I studied homeopathy and in Germany, actually. That was around 1994. And then I went to Switzerland a couple of years later. I was working for a company who developed naturopathic and homeopathic medicines. And I worked there for a couple of years. And then I reopened my practice because I had a practice in Germany when I started. But when I went to Switzerland, I had to close it. And then I reopened my practice in Switzerland. I had to do some new exams because it's not approved, and the German exams are not approved in Switzerland. So I had to do that all over again. And then I started with my practice, and that was 1997 around. And I realized that, or I had a lot of people with vaccine damages in my practice. And that was the reason why I put the website, the German website, www.impfschaden.info. I realized that this is, I think, a very important way to communicate facts about vaccinations that people maybe don't hear in the practice when they go to a doctor.
Yeah.
And that's how I went into that. I started with this website, and it was a tiny little website 15 years ago or 16 years ago. And now it's getting bigger and bigger, you know?
Definitely. What does Impfschaden mean, by the way?
Impfschaden is vaccine injury.
Vaccine injury, yeah.
So it's just the translation where I have the English vaccineinjury.info, and German is just Impfschaden.info. And I just put, when you have a practice, you are treating vaccine-injured people. And I thought, well, it's probably a better idea to warn the people before they get vaccinated and that they think twice about what they want to do with the vaccination, whether they want to really get vaccinated or not. So I thought it's probably better to inform them beforehand and not after, because treating vaccine injuries, it's very hard to treat.
Why is that? I mean, as we get deeper into this, obviously, and talk more about the survey and such, but there's many components to this, but what is it in vaccines that makes people ill, basically, first?
Well, it's not actually the viruses or bacteria parts in it. It's actually the additives and adjuvants in it. So they're like aluminum you find in there. In former times, or in some vaccines, you still find it is mercury. But they took that out. But the other things you have in it, like, I think the worst thing you have in a vaccine is aluminum. And because aluminum is a metal which is very reactive,
Yeah.
And when you ingest it, it's not that bad when you ingest it, because the resorption rate of aluminum is around 0.1%, 0.3%. But when you inject it, the absorption is 100%. And this aluminum makes a reaction in the body, which is actually wanted by the manufacturer, because it makes an infection, it makes an inflammation on the site of the injection. Otherwise, if you would inject only viruses or bacteria, there won't be any reaction at all.
So they need to, they trigger it in some way with the aid of the aluminum.
Yeah, it's kind of a trigger. They put that in. But the problem is that your immune system didn't learn, it doesn't know what to do with the aluminum. One possibility is you can get rid of it, but that's not working in all the people. So when you can't get rid of it, this aluminum is stored somewhere. And when it's stored somewhere, it makes an inflammation on this site. And the problem is that it can go to your brain. When it's in your brain, you get an inflammation in your brain. And these are a lot of injuries which occur in the first couple of months when you get vaccinated. So at the newborns or with the newborns.
That's a major problem, obviously, with this. Now, as I understand as well, aluminum is one of the few chemical elements, whatever we should classify it as, that actually can pass the blood-brain barrier as well. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, that's correct. And the problem is how to get it out, or how to get it out later from the brain. So you can't get it out later.
And let's say it doesn't reach your brain. How does one go about getting out of aluminum if it's somewhere in the body still stored?
Well, the problem is it's so reactive, so it binds to all other components. That's why they put it in there. So, for example, they can put aluminum also with a tetanus shot. And they put it in a tetanus shot because the aluminum is binding the tetanus toxin. And so this new component is more reactive than if they just would inject the tetanus toxin. And this thing, if it's not going to the, this compound, if it's not going to the brain, your white blood cells, they will take it, but they don't know how to what to do with it, because your body never learned to phagocyte or to react to this aluminum, because aluminum was never free, in the entire evolution. Aluminum, although it's the third, it's the third most common metal we have.
Yeah.
But it was still, in the Earth crust, it's coming with, what do you call that? The other, with other minerals.
Right.
So it's always stuck to other minerals. And in your body, it reacts to other things. So it has to react because it's so, it's kind of reactive, this aluminum. It's like fluoride, for example. And then it sticks to other components and it doesn't, and your immune system has no idea what to do with it. So it's probably, you have it somewhere in your body and you can't get rid of it. And it depends on where it is absorbed or where it's located, that you can have different symptoms out of that. This depends on your genetic makeup, actually. It seems that some people, they are more prone to aluminum toxicity than other people. So it can be that there's just one injection with one vaccine is enough. With other people, maybe they need 20 vaccines or 30 vaccines when they reach the maximum or the critical point.
So it is accumulative within the body, as you say, and okay, granted, it might be stored in different parts of the body, depending on how it tries to deal with it. But what would you say are the main effects of this? If we assume that a person has gotten a lot of vaccine throughout the years, or from their early childhood years, and then they get some extra ones later in life, what could happen when you have a buildup of aluminum? And what are some of the symptoms of this?
Well, there are so many symptoms out of that. So it can be neurological because aluminum is a known neurological toxin. And you can have, I just mentioned the most important ones. So neurological symptoms and autoimmune symptoms. So autoimmunity is a major component here. And the other thing is allergies. Aluminum is known to change your immune system. You have two major ways your immune system is reacting. And the one is producing antibodies, and the other way is just it's called cellular immunity. And when you inject aluminum, your immune system is changing to produce antibodies. That's what the manufacturer actually wants. He wants to prove that his vaccine is working, and he can prove. So proof, I don't mean really proof, but they think they can prove it by saying, well, the antibodies, they were rising. And so when they are rising, you can be sure that that the vaccine is working.
Right.
So this is called the titer. You know, the titer is the amount of antibodies you have in your body. And when it reacts, they can say, well, okay, your immune system is reacting to the vaccine, and that's why you have it's good to go, you know?
Right, right. So as a homeopath, Andreas, how do you view the reasoning of this procedure of injecting viruses and bacteria into the body in order to get it to build up a resistance? Is it a sound principle?
Well, it's a good idea, actually, to say, well, I give the, you make the illness just a little bit in a soft, not in a hard way, but just in a soft way. You're not getting very ill, you just get a little bit ill. And then you are protected from later onsets of the disease, or you're protected later from the disease. But the thing is, when you're not really sick, your protection is a little low. You know, you don't have the same protection with a vaccine than with when you have the illness yourself.
Right.
So the idea is not bad, but the problem is that how it's handled, it's rather worse than it's for good.
Maybe we can get into that a little bit and define that for us in terms of how it is handled. I'm of course thinking about children, smaller children, that even though doses might be minute and small, it still is a difference. I always believe to inject something in the way intravenously like that into the body as opposed to being exposed to it through, breathing something in or eating something, or, you know, okay, granted, maybe there could be a cut or something where you get some bacteria on or something, but it's very different, isn't it?
Yeah, that's very different. But the thing is, for children, you have the vaccines contain actually more than for adults.
Really?
Yeah, huh. Because children don't react to the vaccine, so they have to add more of it. And the children will, or the little kids will react. Otherwise, it doesn't work. So the antigen amount is far more, or is way more than in the adult vaccine.
Hmm.
So it's not the additives. The additives are more or less the same, but the antigens are more in the kids' vaccine. That's why you have different vaccines for children and for adults.
Right.
And the thing is with the aluminum, I think one important point here is then the maximum amount of aluminum intake should not be more than 1 milligram per day. 1 milligram per day aluminum. Oral intake. The number came down from 7 milligram. Now it's at 1 milligram. But this is oral intake. So I mentioned earlier, you only absorb 0.1% of this aluminum intake when you take it orally. So you absorb like 1 milligram, you absorb like 10 micrograms of the aluminum.
right.
per day. So this is the maximum amount. And like a normal tetanus shot, depends on what product you take, but a normal tetanus shot contains between 0.5 and 1.5 milligram of aluminum.
Wow, that's quite a bit then, actually.
Yeah, it's a lot. And imagine that, well, it's not here in Switzerland or in Germany or in Europe, but in the US, you get a lot of single shots. And when you add up all these single shots, well, you can leave the doctor's office with maybe 5 milligram of aluminum.
Jeez. Wow.
So this is a thousandfold the maximum amount or the allowance.
There has been stories of people literally passing out after getting vaccines. I mean, you can tell us more about this, of course, what some of the worst case scenarios have been to some of the minor effects that people get. But I've remember stories of people who literally they get sick, they pass out. There's probably people even that had died right there, correct?
Well, but these are more acute, I think, acute symptoms or acute reactions. Well, this is happening, but I think this is not the major part. The major part are the chronic diseases. And the chronic diseases, it's hard to prove that it's from the vaccine, but because they come up you don't leave the practice and a day later or a couple of hours later, you have this chronic condition. This chronic condition is developing weeks, months, or maybe even years after the vaccine.
Yeah.
And you can imagine that maybe you have a vaccine in the summertime, and then next spring you have a chronic condition, you have something, nobody's thinking of the vaccine anymore. And when you go to the doctor and say, well, I have this rheumatoid arthritis or something else, and you say, well, wasn't I vaccinated against rubella or measles or whatever? They just say, well, this has nothing to do with it. It's just, well, you have it developed after the vaccine, but not through the vaccine. This is just the common answer you get. So I think it's like 99% of my patients, and from other stories I get, it's always the same. So when they go to the doctor and say, well, didn't I just have the vaccine? And they always say, no, it doesn't have to do with it.
Yeah, right.
And the interesting thing is because I was, in the beginning, I was a little surprised why they don't want to see it. And I purchased a book, what they have for, it's a book for pediatricians at the university. So it's just a study book and has like, I think, 800 pages. And it's all the topics in there if you want to be a pediatrician to pass your exams. And what I found about vaccinations in this 800-page book was a little bit like a quarter page. So about vaccinations, about vaccine injuries. And the only vaccine injuries they mentioned there were just acute symptoms. They didn't even mention chronic symptoms or chronic conditions. They didn't mention neurological problems, developmental problems, autoimmune disease, nothing. So that's why if you go to the doctor and say, well, doesn't has that to do something with the vaccine? They say, well, probably not. Well, they don't even say probably not. They say, no, it has nothing to do with that. That comes from something else. So they are looking for all the other reasons to explain why you are sick now. And that's happening a lot, unfortunately. So the stories I got from other people, it's just the same story all over again.
Let's talk about that and get into the study that you did, and you can give us some of the background of that, of course, of what you did and everything. But a lot of people were checked. I think you have 111 stories, right, of both children and adults that basically have not been vaccinated. Tell us more about it.
Well, these stories just came up because I did this survey. I started the survey 2 years ago, and I was just asking people on the state of health of their unvaccinated children. And I got, until now, I have it on the German website and I have it on the English website. And up until now, I have 18,000 people. In this, it's not a study actually, it's just a survey. So it's just a personal survey I'm doing here. And from these 18,000 people, I got stories. They just wrote me about their children. And I thought this is so fascinating. I just put these stories together. And that's why I put these stories in a little book. And it's just because it's the stories. Behind all these number, when you go to the website, you see a lot of charts and everything. And I just wanted to give people a little, well, a little background stories of the people who took part in this survey.
So you did a little bit of a deeper analysis, obviously, of these people and their past history and everything else. Now, have you, in terms of the almost 18,000 people that you've or that has participated in the survey, in other words, has this been primarily through the website, or have you talked with many of these people yourself?
Well, it's primarily over the website. I talked to some of them, especially with the book, because when I wanted to have a little bit more, let's say, a little bit more into, wanted to go them more into detail a little bit, I talked to them. But most of them are just, I don't know. I know over the email contact, but not personally.
Very good. It's fascinating, of course, to see when some of these numbers fall into place and on how it is. But what was the why did you want to do this overall to begin with, Andreas? What was your reasoning behind it?
Well, the thing is that I knew somehow that, I thought I knew that unvaccinated children are healthier than vaccinated children. But I wanted to just kind of prove it, in quotes.
Right.
And I just want to see that it's not just my thinking that I want to think, well, unvaccinated children are healthier than vaccinated children. So, you can have like a blind spot there and think, well, they are probably healthier. And that's why I put that up. And the thing is, when you look at the numbers, it's really astonishing, the differences between vaccinated and unvaccinated children. And this is what I wanted to have like black and white, that people can look it up. And that was just, I think that was my intention to do this.
And you're doing the work that obviously those who are developing the vaccines should do.
They should have done that for decades, actually.
That's so right.
This is overdue, but they say, well, they are not enough unvaccinated children. They can't do it. This is an argument you often hear. But, I have like 18,000 people now, well, worldwide, but I think from the U.S. I have like 9,000 right now. I have it from all different countries. But this wouldn't be, a hard-to-do study, actually. It's easy to find these people. And but the thing is, they are not doing it because they know how the results and the outcome of the study would be. And that's why they are not doing it.
Right, right. When did this, if you know, Andreas, about the history of this a little bit, I'm always intrigued to know how some of these things from the so-called orthodox medical field, as we know, it's nothing orthodox with it. It's actually very brand spanking new in the late 1800s, really, where a lot of these procedures kind of come onto the scene, and with the science that comes out through the Rockefeller Foundation and the institute that they founded in terms of the medical establishment and everything else is really when this comes into the Western world and established. But I'm always intrigued why people would just kind of hand over their kids to these physicians and just agree with this. How did this begin, do you think, with the vaccinations overall?
Well, that they agree with the vaccination, you mean?
Yeah, that they trust it, I guess, or that I would guess that a lot of it hasn't been mandatory. I know that certain things are at this stage, maybe, but in many cases, this was voluntary, and people thought, yeah, it's the right thing to do, right? They were propagandized by the medical companies, correct?
Yeah, it's a lot. I think the fear factor is a major point here. So you probably wouldn't vaccinate your children if there wouldn't be this fear. And when you go to the doctor's office, they say, well, if you don't vaccinate, then this and that and this can happen. And they make you so hopeless. And they think, well, if you don't vaccinate your child, your child is going to die within the next week.
Jeez.
And they just convince you that it's so necessary, otherwise your child is in danger.
Yeah, they go for the emotional aspect to this.
That's,
for sure.
It's just an emotional aspect, and it's not well, it has nothing or not much to do with facts, actually. They don't convince you with facts there. They convince you with fear. I have a daughter as well, and we were looking for a pediatrician. And we found a pediatrician, but that one is not very close. So we always have to drive there by car. And we thought, well, we better look for a different one. And I found one in our little town. And we went there. We had an appointment. And then, well, I think our daughter was like, I don't know, 6 months old. And when we just went there, he was asking, yeah, how about the vaccinations? And then he wanted to talk us into that. And well, then he realized that I could answer all his questions. And then I was questioning him. And suddenly he wasn't, I think he never got that in his practice, that anybody is questioning what he's saying.
Right.
Then he stopped talking. And I think they just try to convince you to say, well, you need this vaccine. This is recommended. You need the mumps, measles, rubella vaccine. It's now your child is a year old. You just have to do it. And most of the people, they don't they don't question this what the doctor says.
That's right. They get trained, obviously, when they get their education, and they I question if any of them actually really have looked into it at all. They question they trust rather the compartmentalized standard that you get within the medical field, I think, and they don't know too much as well, right? Because when you begin to ask questions, they defend it up to a certain point, but then they can't really say that much more about it, correct?
Yeah, that's the problem. So you have to know a lot to question the doctor's arguments,
That's right.
And if you don't have, if you don't anything about vaccination and just think, well, they're not good, you are lost. And you have to study it, actually. So, but a lot of people are realizing that. I think in the last three years, there's a major shift concerning vaccines. And more people realize that it's not at all, or it's not good at all. And well, I realized that also in the survey that a lot of people and a lot of children are very young. So most of the parents here have like children which are 2 or 3 years old.
And 2 to 3 years old, yeah.
Yeah, and well, I started the survey 2 years ago, so end of 2010. So right now, these children are okay. They are like 4 or 5 now, but it showed me that the people are waking up. And this wake-up process started, I think, 3 years ago.
Let me ask you this, then, a little bit more in terms of the nature of the survey. obviously what some of the questions were, but it would be interesting if I look at this, let's say from what a critic to this might say to you, and they might say that, all right, well, the survey would attract those who are biased against vaccines to begin with, so they would, you know, answer the questions in a certain way. What could you say to that, and how was the survey set up, Andreas?
Well, this is definitely true. So when you say, well, you just have you have this survey or the questionnaire just on your website, and then anybody can go there and anybody can answer that. And this is probably something which can be I can't discern that. But the thing is, when you do a study, you're always looking for people which suited for your study, and you need a special group of people. So you need, when you want to study people getting a hepatitis B shot, you're looking for the people vaccinated with hepatitis B shot. And if you're not looking for, and if you're looking for unvaccinated people, you're just getting the unvaccinated people. So, I know I don't have the power, and I don't have the money to make a really study, you know. So I really had to put it on the website to attract the people. But my feeling is, from the answers I get from these people, is that people who take part in the unvaccinated group, they are very honest. And most of them, they also write, and I have a little free text section there, and they just write me stories, like the ones which are in the book. But they just write stories about their children in there. They just don't make it up, you know. And I think this is, I can only see whether these stories are true or not, where I can write back to the people and ask them, is that correct what you wrote? But I never can prove it, you know.
Right.
But, overall, if I only would have 100 stories or 100 questionnaires or maybe 500, you can say, well, maybe this is biased and it's not true. But now, you know, with 18,000 people, the results are very similar. And the interesting thing is, I have it on the German and the English website. And the results on both websites are pretty much the same.
That's really interesting. Yeah, that's a good point, actually. And I have to say as well, 18,000, that is a lot, actually, for a survey. When you look at, for example, a news headline or something like that, and they say, you know, whatever, it could be about a political issue or something like that, and they say, oh, 53% favors, you know, this versus that, let's say. And then you actually look at the survey that they've done for this, and it's rarely above 80, 90 people. Over 100 is very rare, you know, and then they try to claim that this is how a whole country feels or something like that, you know.
So, yeah, correct.
Yeah, so this is, it's a lot. 18,000 is a good turnout, actually.
I think it's more or less representative, even when I can't prove it. But I think I don't have to prove it. It's just, and when people read it, it's interesting to read how the illnesses are in other or in unvaccinated children or in vaccinated ones. I don't want to prove it. If I would have for a medical study, you probably need $200,000 at least. That I would do it, but I think this is not there's no reason why to do it, you know.
Right. Yeah, exactly. They don't have that incentive. And of course, I think they're more or less scared in terms of what they would find out as well. So they just try to avoid it, you know. But it's interesting, as you said, you said that they come from a position where they know that it works, so they don't feel the need to disprove it. Otherwise, in other regards, when you bring something new to the market, shall we say, or offering a new service, then obviously your position there is that you have to prove to those who you want to sell it to that it you know, that it works or that it's good or anything like that. But that doesn't seem to have happened with vaccines. It was just there and established pretty much, right?
Well, it's kind of, well, it's an establishment thing. Yeah, that's correct. And the only proof they do is what I just mentioned is the amount of antibodies you are having after the vaccine. So this is the only proof they are doing. So they don't do any trials where they vaccinate one part of the or one group of the people and don't vaccinate the other part of the or the other group of the people, and then they maybe they infect the people on purpose. They don't do that. So there's actually not a real proof that it works. So it's the only thing that it's proving is the amount of antibodies they have.
Yeah.
But this doesn't say anything about your protection, actually. It just says something that you reacted to the antigen in the vaccine, but it doesn't say that you are protected.
Yeah, that's right. The risks here that are involved with the side effects, they largely outweigh the claimed benefits. That's what you would argue here, I guess, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, when they do a study, they do the studies in different ways to conceal the side effects. So this is, I think, the only medical product which has these these strange guidelines for trials. So, for example, they don't give a placebo. They don't give a placebo to the control group. The placebo in most, sometimes you have an exception, but in most of the time, the placebo group gets a different vaccine. So, for example, they test a five fold vaccine like tetanus, diphtheria, Haemophilus influenza, pertussis, and then they want to test it with a placebo. Then they just take a different vaccine. Maybe they take a five fold vaccine, and then they take as a placebo, they take a six fold vaccine. So they just want to be sure that the adjuvants in the control group are pretty much the same than, or maybe even contain more adjuvants than in the group where they test the vaccine. So this is not, the placebo is not just as a salty fluid, like with, what do you call that, chloride and sodium chloride. It's just a different vaccine. Or the other thing they are doing, they take as a placebo, they take only the adjuvants. They don't take the bacteria or the antigens. They just take the adjuvants. So they want to be sure that aluminum, all the other stuff is in there. And the reason why they are doing it, it's clear, because when you put, when you give one group, you give the plus, so just the adjuvants, and the other group, you give the adjuvants plus the antigen, then you can be sure that the side effects are pretty much the same. So the results then are, the placebo was as well tolerated, or the vaccine was as well tolerated as the placebo. So we can't assume that there are no real side effects.
Wow.
And this is what is generally done. You don't find, sometimes you find it, but in general, you don't find vaccine studies that use real placebos.
That is bizarre. But why? What's the reasoning behind that then? What would happen if they did?
Yeah, the reasoning behind that is that the side effects would be way more in the vaccine group than in the placebo group when they would use a real placebo. And just to hide this. They just take the placebo. They don't take a real placebo. They take the adjuvant placebo. It's just hiding the symptoms, you know, it's hiding side effects.
Exactly. That's very clever. Now, considering that they know that there are certain compounds in there, like aluminum and such, have they, as far as you know, done any follow-up study on people later down the road, you know, 10, 20, even 30 years later to see what the long-term effects are? And I mean, what you should do in that case, I guess, would do hair analysis and things like that so you could see the accumulation of certain metals that they have done, you know, have in the vaccines. Have anything like this been done in your knowledge?
Well, they don't do this. What they are doing in some cases, they do these post-marketing surveillance studies so that they just look for people who are getting side effects maybe after the clinical study is over. And then they just collect all the the illnesses or all the conditions people get after the study is the clinical study is over. But this goes on maybe 1 or 2 years. Mm-hmm. And most clinical studies actually they maybe last, I think the longest are lasting 42 days.
Really?
Most of the studies, they just last maybe a week, 2 weeks after the vaccination. So everything which is coming up 3 weeks after the vaccine, well, this has nothing to do with the vaccine anymore. It doesn't show up in the package leaflet.
Wow.
And, you know, and when it comes up later, then you have to prove that this has to do with the vaccination, and that's the real problem. That's what I just mentioned in the beginning.
Yeah, that's right. They won't connect it with that, and if they, you know, they claim it to be something else. So where is some of the responsibility on this? It's of course different for all countries and everything else, but if we look at the European Union, and you can certainly tell us if it's different in Switzerland as well as opposed to this, but is this simply something that's overseen by a health body of each country and they are ultimately responsible, or is it the medical companies that provide the vaccine that is supposed to do this kind of checkup and tests?
Well, the tests, actually, the studies are done only by the companies. So there's no independent department of health, neither in Germany, Switzerland, or not in the U.S. So all the studies are done by the manufacturer. And, well, you know how it works with the studies from the manufacturers.
That's right. So yeah.
You know beforehand what you want to have as a result. So you can construct your studies just with a turnout you wanted.
Now, as we know, in when we have different setups in terms of medicine in primarily socialized countries, we have governments that usually, in a way, are not accountable, and it's increasingly difficult, let's say, to hold somebody accountable. Let's say a doctor had administered something that made someone sick or something like that, but as far as you know, are there any other cases where, well, I know, of course, that the vaccine companies have been sued. My God, there's been so many of these going on in the U.S., I believe. But is there anyone that actually has managed to gotten anyone, convicted, I guess we could say? I mean, this is one case. I don't mean to go off on a tangent here, Andreas, but I remember looking at it before we talked here today. A couple of years ago, I think it was Merck that actually... or Bayer, one of these that managed to put into the vaccines I'm going to find that because we had it up on the website.
The SV40?
Yeah, this was the intended for hemophiliacs, and they actually put AIDS-infected something in with blood clots into the vaccine. Do you remember the story?
Yeah, I heard about that. Correct. I think, wasn't it... they didn't put it in on purpose, didn't they? Or I think they didn't throw it away because they knew that it was infected or it was contaminated.
Yeah, that's right. But instead of getting rid of it, they started to dump it on other markets in Asia, Latin America, and some European countries as well.
Yeah, I think that was the reason. I think they just didn't want to dump it, so they just sold it.
Amazing. That's amazing. So who, in that case, who is,
Well, in this case, the company is reliable, but if you have a vaccine damage of a vaccine which is recommended by your country, so the state is responsible.
They are,
but the thing is, well, you have to prove it. And these vaccine trials, they are going on forever. So it's for the people, it is like a nightmare. They are suing, and they have to, like, you probably need a 10-year period. You need 10 years to get a vaccine damage. What do you call that? To win a vaccine damage case.
Yeah.
So that takes you probably 10 years.
Wow.
And this is just normal because they say, well, you have to go to the social courts and then to different courts, and it's always be rejected. It will be rejected. And the thing is, you need somebody who can write something about your vaccine damage, because they won't just say, well, I have this vaccine damage, and I say it's from the vaccine, but I can't prove it really. And you need somebody, you need kind of an expert who's writing something about your vaccine damage. And he has to prove, this expert, that your vaccine damage is probable. Otherwise, you don't have a chance.
Right.
So you need other people who have the same problems, and maybe people who already won a vaccine trial. And when you have that, maybe your chance are rising that you can win this case. But otherwise, you don't have a chance. And the thing is, these experts who are doing these papers for you, or give their assessment or the reports they are writing. It's pretty hard to find somebody who is really independent. So at least this is at least in Germany or in Switzerland, it's really hard to find somebody who can write you something which is not in favor of the company.
Yeah.
Of the vaccine.
Right.
But you need somebody like that. And this is the reason why a lot of people say, when they really have a vaccine damage, they say, well, I don't do that. I'm not going to trial. I'm not going to court. I don't want to do that, because it's wrecking the people.
Yeah, it's a very good point. It's very discouraging, of course, because you're back into that scenario where basically no one is accountable. No, none of the studies has been done. So again, it ends up in the hands of people like yourselves, who want to look into this and actually try to do some real data, searching on this. And ultimately, again, people's own responsibility of not trusting what the doctor say, just because they have a white coat on doesn't mean that they know more than you do in some cases. You're back in that situation again. But let's do this, Andreas. I wanted to take a break here in a little bit. I want to, in the second segment, continue to talk more about some of the cases, if you will, some of the more in-depth studies that you did with the 111 different people. So there's lots more to talk about there. But let's give out some of the websites, and I want to, you to mention how people can get a hold of the book as well. It's called Vaccine Free: 111 Stories of Unvaccinated Children. And as you give out the website as well, let us know if anyone can participate still in the survey, and how long you plan to have it open and available, Andreas.
Well, the survey is actually it's an ongoing survey. There is no closing date for that. So it's ongoing. Everybody can participate. And this is on vaccineinjury.info, the survey. So we probably have more English listeners. For the German listeners, that would be impfschaden.info. So they are on both websites. On the German, well, it's in German, and on the English, it's in English.
Makes sense.
I, I also have like I have a translation for Spanish people, so only Spanish people can take part in the survey. And there's actually a different survey with vaccinated children there as well. Because I got a lot of questions, and I said, "Well, why don't you do that with vaccinated children as well?" And I put that up a little later. So I only have like over 2,000 people. But this is for people who have vaccinated children and unvaccinated. They can take part in both of the surveys.
Very, very good. Impfschaden.info for our German audience, and then vaccineinjury.info for our international audience. And the book is available through that both websites as well, correct?
Well, it's not on the I have it on the website, but it's just available over Amazon. You can get it at Amazon.
Amazon.com. Okay, very good. Well, Andreas, stay with us here. We'll take a short break, and then we'll continue to talk more in the second hour. I've paid my dues. Time after time, I've done my sentence, but committed no crime. And bad mistakes, I've made a few. I've had my shouts and kicks in my face, but I've come through. And I need to go home.
Thank you all, but it's been no bed of roses.